This is the Music Therapy Research Podcast, in affiliation with the blog at www.musictherapyresearchblog.com. Hosts of the show are Dr. Blythe Lagasse at Colorado State University and Andrew Knight at University of North Dakota. The purpose of this podcast is to provide some insight to the research that affects the world of music therapy, especially to help our students and current clinicians better understand how evidence-based practice can improve the lives of our clients, patients, and consumers. Welcome to our Music Therapy Podcast. We're recording this August 18th, 2010, and Blythe and I have a couple different articles that we'd like to talk about today. We'll go through, Blythe has two articles. I've got one in particular that I thought was interesting. We'll talk a little bit about some other podcasts. And we'll also explain a brief little Twitter segment so that something else that you can follow us at. And we'll preview also that we're going to be going to Seattle, which is kind of exciting, going to a conference out there next week. That will be very interesting for music cognition and perception. And, of course, tie in real closely with all the issues that we hopefully want to talk about. Lots of great researchers, and, of course, it's an international conference. So some great conference material from all across the world. Looking forward to meeting a lot of international scholars as well. But let's get right into the research today. Blythe, what do you want to talk about first? You've got a couple different articles.
Yeah, I chose two articles today that are actually, I think, related in kind of an odd way. The first article is Social Skill Interventions for Individuals with Autism, Evaluation for Evidence-Based Practices Within a Best Evidence Synthesis Framework. So this article is actually a synthesis paper, basically, where they went out and looked at all the different treatments that are being researched with children with autism, specifically between 2001 and 2008, and they tried to come to some conclusion of what is shown to be evidence-based out there. So interventions that they considered were ABA, or Applied Behavior Analysis, naturalistic interventions, parent training interventions, visual interventions, and visual modeling interventions. Within this, they also mentioned music therapy articles, or they found music therapy articles that were included in the review. However, they didn't actually comment on these in the text. So this article is really interesting to me because the results of the article found that out of all the treatments that were out there, the only one that they considered evidence-based was social skills groups for children with autism. So these are general social skills groups where the children are practicing social skills. And that makes sense, since in order to learn social skills, you should be in a social environment. They also mentioned one that has enough evidence to be considered promising or a potential evidence-based practice, which was visual modeling. So these two interventions were mentioned specifically to have enough evidence to really be considered. But all the others that they looked at did not have enough evidence. And this is important to us for a couple of reasons, I think. First, music therapy articles were found. That's great. But they weren't mentioned within the text because there weren't enough articles for them to look at. However, when you look at all the different therapies and treatments that they found, none of them were proven. They had social groups shown to be evidence-based practice, but there's so many techniques out there for children with autism, and as a clinician, I often hear, well, this has been proven for children with autism, or this you need to do with your child with autism because it works. Well, the research isn't confirming that right now, and I think that's really important, which is really hard for the parents of children with autism who don't know what to do with their children, but also important for us as researchers because it's kind of like an open playing field. Here we have a great tool that could be extremely valuable for children with autism. But it's not evidence-based yet. There's not enough evidence to say this is best practice as of now. So what does that mean? That means we need to do more research on the effect of music therapy techniques or styles with children who have autism. And it's really, really exciting, I think.
You know, I did ABA line therapy work when I was, when I was in graduate school. Have you ever done ABA work, Blythe?
I have, yes.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I wonder if, because one of the things that I've seen a lot is ABA is a real prominent therapy, and I don't think that the ABA group would take this sort of information very well. It seems like they would. But we've got mounds of evidence. We've got this, and there, you know. So all the different groups that are mentioned in this article, you know, it's a point of contention. I'm sure that just like the ABA group, I'm sure there are music therapists that said, we've worked with kids with autism. I've seen it. They've been in front of me, and they have been able to acquire or in some way generalize these social skills. It has worked for me. And so you have this sort of battle of the anecdotal evidence versus, you know, studies that are specific to one of these domains, I guess, if you'd call them that, in all these different areas. And yet here is something that purportedly would be somewhat removed, and you know, that the authors are third party to all this, not trying to promote any specific way to go about helping children with autism acquire social skills, and yet they've only come up with this basic idea that says, go ahead, everyone, do the research. Just like you said, it's open. If you see something, you got to go after it, but you got to do due diligence in doing it. What do you see as sort of what sort of music therapy studies do you see that would benefit kids with autism in terms of social skills? What would be something that would put music therapy on the map of the next synthesis, best evidence synthesis, right, paper like this?
Well, I don't think it's one particular style or one type of music therapy or one intervention. I think what's really important is that we do randomized controlled trial studies with children with autism showing that different techniques work. So finding statistical significance. And that's why it can be so difficult. So you were talking about how, you know, this might be a point of contention for some practitioners in ABA or other areas. But this is also why meta-analysis and synthesis are so extremely valuable, because it's someone taking an outside look, looking at all of the research, and then saying, well, what is really out here? And keep in mind, this is on social skills particularly, so that's not saying that these aren't shown in communication skills alone or other areas. But as far as music therapy, randomized controlled trials. There's a couple issues with randomized controlled trials. Number one, if you're not familiar with a randomized controlled trial, this is a type of research where you have at least two groups. One group is treatment and one group is control, and you randomly assign participants to one of the two groups. So everyone has an equal chance of being in the treatment or control group. Other issues with this is that you need enough participants in each group to have enough power, or so that you can infer anything from the statistics. So a typical number that you're looking for in a randomized controlled trial is 15 in each group is really, really great. Now think about children with autism. How can you get 30 children, because we have two groups, 30 children that are similar enough that they can be considered a population that's basically equal? That becomes very, very difficult. So what you oftentimes see is single subject designs or case studies rather than randomized controlled trials. However, were you going to say something, Andrew?
No, I think I was mostly agreeing with, you know, we've all been through that sort of idea of research design. And you think, well, okay, I've got a school district. And then you think about the numbers, you know, the numbers going from 1 out of 150 kids, and then those numbers keep going down in terms of autism prevalence, and you go, okay, I think I've got, you think you've got an advantage in terms of overall prevalence of this particular spectrum disorder, but then you also have this idea that because it is a spectrum, you have to do so many assessments ahead of time, and then you have to find the 30 kids who are matching in these select areas of social skills under these assessments. So it's sort of like you think you'd have enough, but it's not just a matter of getting any kid between the age of whatever and whatever, you know, 4 and 5 with autism who has that diagnosis. It's much more particular than that.
It is. And because of that, it can become very difficult to find enough research participants for a study within any, you know, geographical location. An example of a nice randomized controlled trial, however, is my second study. which is a study completed by Kim and Wigram. And this study is the effect of improvisational music therapy on joint attention behaviors in autistic children, a randomized control study. So here, this study is specifically looking at a joint attention skills, but it's a beautifully designed study. There are a couple issues with it. They have in this study, I believe, 10 children total. They started with 15, so they had five that dropped out during the study, so that's a one-third attrition rate, which is pretty high, but they do list the reasons why they believe that the attrition occurred. So the numbers overall are also pretty small, 10 children. And there are some breaks in the treatment, according to the write-up that they did on this study, due to vacation and illness. So a child may have had a little bit longer of a time to go through the study than other children. Other than that, they have a nice randomized control trial where they're looking at music therapy intervention, specifically improvisation, versus another type of treatment, which is play intervention. And that's a really great way to do a randomized controlled trial, because if you just take music therapy intervention and compare it to nothing, there's that is something better than nothing effect, that the children getting something might show progress just because they're getting something. So here they're actually putting it against play therapy or a play intervention that the children are doing. They do find significant results, and they're using some standardized or accepted behavior measuring scales, which is nice to see as well. So they're not just using a scale that they came up with. I chose this study because basically it's kind of what we need to strive for as music therapists. Although it can be improved upon as far as research, some of the variables, participants, and so forth, this is the type of study that is going to be recognized by someone who is doing a meta-analysis or a synthesis or a review paper. They're going to see studies like this, and these are the types of studies that will then be listed and then considered when they're looking at evidence-based practice for a certain population. So it's really important that we have more of these studies available in the literature that are showing different effects of music therapy with children with autism.
I wanted to also bring up, I thought it was really interesting, when you, the authors of this study, the first author was the primary author did this as part of his PhD at Aalborg University in Denmark, where Tony Wigram is. And do you remember seeing Tony Wigram talk at our conference?
I do.
2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago?
I think so. And it was on this subject.
Yeah. And so whenever I see, and first of all, if you don't know of Tony Wigram, you should certainly pick up one of his books. He's the kind of guy where, you know, walking by him at the conference, I felt like I could have bumped him in the side and texts would have fallen out of his briefcase or something, because he must walk around with manuscripts constantly. He's a very prolific writer, very prolific author, and obviously professor. And so I would absolutely encourage you to check out some of his stuff. But at the same time, I do remember when I first really got into this idea, was I really enjoyed listening to him talk. He was talking about this idea. One of the main points that I also took away, besides him talking about the different varieties of evidence, he also mentioned, what is this problem of research? How do we wrestle with it in music therapy specifically? And he laid out the problem pretty succinctly, in that I think I remember him saying, you know, professors in academia look to clinicians and say, you should do the research. You have the populations. You have the clients and consumers and patients in droves. And the clinicians look to professors and say, but we're doing therapy with them every day. We don't have time to go around and write. You're getting paid to write. You're the ones that need research articles, you know, for tenure and promotion and that sort of thing. You should be doing this. And so I think he succinctly laid out this dichotomous relationship that really shouldn't be in terms of, if we want to have good, solid research that is communicable to the public and that clinicians can use valuable clinical research, then it's got to be a partnership of all the different parties, including the people who are getting the treatment or their parents and caregivers at the same time. That was one of the crystallized moments for me of his talk to our American Music Therapy Association conference. He did the keynote that year.
I absolutely agree. And it's difficult, but I think those partnerships can exist. We just need to reach out to one another. I've been working with a clinical group, and we've submitted a couple of grant proposals, and we're hoping to do a partnership of research where they'll use my skills as a researcher, and I'll, you know, use them as the clinicians as far as providing the services, making sure that everything's done up to the standards that we have set forth. And I think it's going to be really exciting. So I'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah. And I think just off the top of my head, I'm thinking also, I mentioned AMTA, the American Music Therapy Association, of which we're both members, of course, at our approved universities. But also the research committee, the AMTA research committee, specifically is looking to engage researchers and clinicians, or I should say academics and clinicians, in terms of doing grant writing for research grants that they are supporting as well, that AMTA is supporting. So I'm sure that Dr. Wigram's message was not lost on many of us who were in attendance that day, which is, it's good to see that came onto that. I think it's kind of fitting, you know, we both came up with our articles randomly. We didn't put any constraints on what kind of articles we wanted to talk about first. And you come up with, you have the RCT, the last article, and then you also have that overview of the evidence basis for the different social skills. My article also falls under one of these really high levels of research, you know, these really difficult to do, but when they're out there, they're really important. So mine is a meta-analysis study, and it's the sort of thing that catches your eye, and I think the title catches the eye of a lot of people in the media. It's called Mozart Effect, Schmozart Effect, a meta-analysis, and it's out of the University of Vienna, the Faculty of Psychology. It was just published in 2010, in April of this year, and I chose it because I'm actually doing some research myself with another professor in a research department on my campus at University of North Dakota right now. Stuff that isn't music therapy, but it is related. The idea of Mozart Effect is related to music therapy. It's something that whether or not we want to be talking about it, we certainly should know about it in terms of when people might come to us and say, but isn't this music therapy? They listened and they got smarter, or these people listened and then this happened, listened to music and then this happened. So we're doing music therapy here. We don't need a music therapist, maybe. Especially, it's a good moment for advocacy, I think. So the more we know about the Mozart Effect, the better. So that's sort of the caveat that Mozart Effect is intertwined in the overall context about music therapy. You also have this notion of the Mozart Effect expanding from the original 1993 study that I'll talk about in a second, that it's still, it did raise sort of a consciousness, at least in the United States, where you can go to a store like Target or Best Buy, you know, sort of a big box chain store, and you can find CDs on an end cap where the CD will be meant to, these 12 tracks were specifically designed by this composer to increase this, that, or the other thing, relaxation or intelligence, or these specific lullabies will activate these brain waves in your child. And some of the claims can be pretty specious and also be in the realm of, why should we have a music therapist? We've got this product that can just do whatever we want it to. But music doesn't really work that way, and that's sort of where music therapists need to understand about their training and how to understand our training, I think. The history of the Mozart Effect, as I mentioned, goes back to 1993. And it was a paper that came out by Rosho Shaw and Kai in the journal Nature, which is a real prominent journal. You know, you get published in Nature, that means that you have really significant findings that are groundbreaking in many ways. there have been previous meta-analysis of all the Mozart effects, and everything stems back to this 93 study. So the basic first study was essentially about 30 or so subjects, which are college students, and this was done by researchers in psychology, not specifically in music. And they played a specific Mozart sonata for two pianos in D major, and they played about 10 minutes of it. And then after that, they gave the assessment that they gave was spatial rotation or spatial ability tasks. You can think of it as some way to measure your spatial IQ would be if you looked at like a kid's block that maybe has a semicircle on the bottom and is 90 degrees and a couple other 90 degree angles and some jutting out. And then if you flip that block, if you turned it about 90 degrees on an axis, would you still be able to recognize that that's the same block that you were looking at? That's a real elementary example, but that sort of gives the idea. Are you able to say that that thing right there turned is the same thing as this thing that I'm holding over in my right hand? It's a different way to understand a different kind of intelligence. The basic idea being the group that listened to Mozart, this recording of the two piano sonata in D major, scored to be about 8 to 9 points higher on their spatial IQ as measured by a Stanford-Binet intelligence test. That was a short-lived effect. It only lasted about 15 minutes after the testing period, but it got published in Nature. It is interesting and certainly can go in different directions. Unfortunately, in many cases, the direction that it went was out the media door and got blown up into this Mozart can make a kid smarter, all the way to, and I think the great anecdote that everyone wants to point out is the governor of Georgia in the mid-90s, Zell Miller, mandated that CDs had to be given out to all babies born in his state of Georgia when they were born, trying to raise the overall intelligence of Georgia. I don't know exactly where he was trying to go with that, but it certainly is an interesting story that came out of it. So fast forward all these years, almost 20 years later now, and we've had plenty of different analysis, lots of people trying to replicate the study, see if there are any, see if there's any crossover in other areas of intelligence, mathematics, reading, other examples of literacy, verbal learning, in terms of just listening to music. And a lot of the research has found that that's not really true. Even to the point in pop media now, in a USA Today column in earlier this summer, as a matter of fact, there was a psychologist named Glenn Schellenberg who is quoted famously now as saying, the Mozart effect, that's just crap. He said that flat out in the March 1st version of the Los Angeles Times, actually, not the USA Today. So this meta-analysis that I'm looking at that was just published in Intelligence, they had 226 studies that they started with, and again, they had to go through all the different criteria. They boiled it down to about 40 studies, but those 40 studies had over 3,000 subjects to them. The basic findings were that the D, or the effect size, was small, and the music in all the different studies included this specific Mozart sonata, but also might have included as other independent variables just white noise or silence as a control group, pop music, or minimalist music like Philip Glass, Steve Reich sort of examples. And the results have some great tables that included all the studies that were mentioned. They have box and whisker, or what you might call forest plots, to show the effect sizes. And the quote that they put at the end was that, although results indicate a positive, significant effect of exposure to the Mozart sonata compared to no stimulus at all on spatial task performance, observed effects were only small in size. So there was some, you might be able to say there might be some small effect, but only when comparing something to nothing. It doesn't have to be necessarily Mozart, but there was something to nothing. So what does all of this mean is where their discussion sort of ends up. How can we focus the message and use the information as music therapists? Now, there was a study earlier this year that, or not this year, I think it was a year or two ago, that was for people who had strokes, that people who had strokes and listened to music for about 30 minutes a day regained their verbal capacity quicker than control group. And so now we have this question of music listening versus music processing. And might a music therapist be part of a process where, although a music therapist can't be working with somebody with stroke all day, every day, what kind of music should somebody with stroke listen to? Should we only give them Mozart music? Well, if they hate Mozart music, it probably won't be as effective. So where therapists come in, I think, is in the live music category, so they can shape and control the kind of music that's happening. And then the second aspect, which I think is the most important, that these authors also get to, is client-patient-preferred music. The idea that if you don't like it, it's not going to be as effective for you. And it comes down to some of the other articles that were published here. It comes down to arousal and mood. Does this music arouse your brain so that the cognitive goings-on are happening at a level that sort of can kickstart some areas that might have been lost due to stroke, or that in some of the even kids that we see with language impairments, can we stimulate some of the language areas? Can we circumvent some damaged areas of the brain or some areas that aren't fully formed yet? So although it comes down to arousal and mood, there were, that's really our wheelhouse. That's where music therapists, I think, can get onto this message. So when people approach you and talk about the Mozart effect, you can say, those were really interesting studies. The fact is that this is all about arousal. It's about mood. It's about the therapeutic relationship. And it's about being able to move forward from there. And that's where a music therapist can step in. Have you had a lot of experience trying to explain Mozart effect to people, or have you had it come up in any of your clinical work?
Oh, absolutely. So and this idea, in our society where you can, pop on a CD and suddenly become smarter, is very attractive. But with this article, they're showing that that's just not the case. And again, it's the comparison of something to nothing. Well, something got results in the original studies, but when comparing it to other stimuli, you see similar results. And this, I think, is a really interesting point just from a research perspective of kind of that checks and balances of research. Here you have early research articles that indicate that there was, this great effect. It went into the media. It became very public and maybe taken out of perspective with the media. But then later on, you have someone who goes back and looks at the research and compiles it all into one study, a meta-analysis, and can really determine, based on several studies, now 40 studies, is there really an effect with this so-called Mozart effect? And they find very different results. And I think that's very interesting and great for research, because it has some accountability to research to be able to go back and look and see what really works.
It's like I said, it's a sort of a side interest of mine. It's definitely not down the music therapy side of the other research that I'm working on, but it's really interesting, and it's really fun to do this kind of research. So I've been experimenting with some live music listening and some math score stuff versus recorded music. And I think it'll continue to add to the literature that dispels the myth, that can get us down to how can we use it? How can we, let's not just, look at it and poo-poo it and say, that's just silly stuff, but be able to look at it and use it for advocating for music therapy. I think it'll be a really neat thing to do. I also want to drop a line and say that if you're interested in more podcasts about music therapy, if you happen to come across the Music Therapy Research blog in any particular way, we always want to make sure that you know about some other people who are music therapists, friends of ours, who are also doing the podcast thing. If you do like to throw podcasts on your MP3 player of choice and go for a run or a bike ride or just a drive in the car and listen, I would recommend the Music Therapy Roundtable. And there's several of our colleagues are on the Music Therapy Roundtable. You can certainly find them. Is it musictherapyroundtable.com, I believe? And talking about a lot of different contexts in particular, but they also have an RSS feed. You can get them anytime. That's with Michelle Erfurt, Rachel Rambach, and Kimberly Senamore, that you can listen to them. And I'm also going to ask blithe to share something in a second. We're both on Twitter. If you'd like to follow us, our handles are on the outro. You can listen to them there. And then make sure you shoot us a note from time to time and tell us what you think about the podcast or some more ideas. One thing that I'm really enjoying about Twitter, though, is that I can find people that I'm interested in, especially in the realm of music and neuroscience or music therapy research. And one person in particular that came across this week that I wanted to mention was one from Oliver Sacks, who was the famed neurologist, who works in New York and is the subject of the movie Awakenings. If you haven't seen Awakenings, I think it's a great film, won several awards. Robin Williams portrays Oliver Sacks first understanding what became better known as Parkinsonism and then Parkinson's disease. Kind of goes through the understanding of what L-DOPA was and how he understood the neurotransmitter dopamine to be influential in Parkinson's disease. So Oliver Sacks is tweeting, if you can imagine that. So a neurologist stopping halfway around his rounds and whipping out his iPhone and tweeting something. But he tweeted about a great old YouTube clip where Robin Williams is being interviewed on the Actors Studio and discussing Awakenings and specifically the music therapy implications. Oliver Sacks is a big proponent for music therapy. He's got a great, very interesting anecdotal book called Musicophilia that I would recommend for anybody to read. Very interesting stuff about music and neuroscience and some good case studies there. So that's the tweet that reminded me to say, if you're interested, check out YouTube, and then you can Google or you can search on YouTube for Robin Williams discussing Awakenings. I think that was real fun for me to watch this week. Anything in particular come across the tweet deck for you this week, Blythe?
One of my favorite tweeters, I don't know how you say that.
Yeah, are they Twitterers or tweeters? Twitter in the Twitterverse?
Yeah. this whole vernacular here. But to follow is actually Autism Speaks. They actually Twitter or tweet, I guess. And what I love about Autism Speaks, so it's an organization that does advocacy for persons with autism. They have a huge grant program. Wonderful, wonderful organization. And their tweets oftentimes will let you know about fundraising, grant things, but also they do almost, I'd say 2 to 3 times a week, what's new in autism, where when you click on the link, it takes you to a synopsis of all the research and news flashes that are coming out about autism, which as you can probably imagine is quite a lot. So hook up to Autism Speaks on Twitter and you will get those updates right to your tweet deck or Twitter account.
Yeah, however that works. We'll figure
that out by next week or whatever.
If it starts with a TW, you can pretty well figure out that it's there. So that'll wrap it up for our music therapy research podcast this week. And we are going off to Seattle next week to be at the International Conference on Music Perception and Cognition. And that's going to be at the University of Washington in Seattle. And I'm very excited to go. Blythe, you're actually doing a presentation. You've got a session. Is that right?
I'm presenting on neurologic music therapy and kind of the shift in paradigm in music therapy on Thursday morning at 8:30, I think.
And I'll be there, of course, and I'll be trying to track down and rub elbows with some of the great minds that are looking into understanding music in terms of perception and cognition. And there's a music therapy track, as a matter of fact, too, so I'm sort of torn. It's like, should I go? Do I feel like I have allegiance to the music therapy track that I should go there, or do I know the information there, so I need to go to the social psych track that day, or should I go to the neuroscience track that day? It's going to be one of those great conferences that no matter what I'll go to, I'm sure it'll be a great session, plenty of good keynotes, and we'll break it down for you in our next podcast, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the different things we found out that we learned about and some of the great presentations that happened, because it will be research-erific, I think.
Right, and if you want live updates, just go ahead and get onto Twitter, and you can follow either of us, and we'll be giving live updates from the conference.
Yeah, another really cool way to use Twitter is sort of to create this back channel dialogue at these conferences. One of the other things that I was tracking, just to be quick about it, I was tracking the APA conference, the American Psychological Association was having a conference, and they have a back channel Twitter feed that they have this certain hashtag for, and I don't know how I figured it out, but I figured it out, and it was just random. I think Friday night at about 7 p.m., I got this tweet from APA 10 that said, if you want to, you know, we're having a margarita bar out in the lounge in about 15 minutes, everyone joins. So you can just imagine all these psychologists whipping out their smartphones and go, oh, margarita bar, I got to get over to this side of the conference so I can make sure I can attend that social. So that's kind of neat. So we'll be sending out some information, and maybe we'll even be able to announce like some sort of back channel hashtag that we can do for you really professional Twitterers out there. In that case, that'll wrap it up for this week. And we're looking forward to doing some more research with you soon. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast. If you have comments on the podcast or the show, please visit www.musictherapyresearchblog.com. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Search for the handles @ablythel and @knighdmtbc.